Today is Wednesday, March 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, tensions on the Syria-Turkey border.
He says simply that Turkey cannot no longer sustain hosting around 4 million refugees. He says the country cannot take any more, and it's up to Europe to share this responsibility.
Plus, former U.S. Vice President Joe Biden is the big winner from Super Tuesday primary polls, and a new report says freedom and democracy are under threat around the world. Those stories and more are next. A resurgent Joe Biden scored victories from Texas to Massachusetts on Super Tuesday, revitalizing a presidential bid that was teetering on the edge of disaster just days earlier. But rival Democratic Socialist Bernie Sanders, the frontrunner until Tuesday's polls, seized the biggest prize with a win in California. Following Biden's Super Tuesday bounce, billionaire former New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg dropped out of the race to go against President Donald Trump in November. Bloomberg poured more than $500 million of his own personal fortune into his campaign, but only had one win in the small Pacific Islands territory of American Samoa. Bloomberg has since said that he was endorsing Biden. So suddenly, the Democratic Party's presidential field, which featured more than a half dozen candidates a week ago, is a contest focused on two men. For a recap and reaction, I'm joined in studio with VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Thank you, sir.
So can you give us a bit of a recap? What happened yesterday in Super Tuesday?
What happened was very dramatic. This was the single most important day in the U.S. election cycle so far. All of 2019, we saw Joe Biden leading the Democratic pack. The main reason that voters gave was they thought he would be the strongest candidate to take on President Trump in this coming November. And I think we just got confirmation of that in the Super Tuesday voting. There's still a long way to go, though. The Democratic process is one that is complicated. You build delegate totals slowly, and it looks like this could go toward the convention in July before we know for sure who's going to be the Democratic nominee. But make no mistake about it, what happened on Tuesday was dramatic. Biden won in places he was not expected to. There's a tremendous amount of momentum now. And now with Bloomberg out of the race and potentially throwing some money Biden's way, this really changes the dynamic.
Now, where does this leave Bernie Sanders, the senator from Vermont, who has had an incredibly energetic campaign up to this point, has pulled a lot of support and really shaken up the Democratic Party? Where does this leave him?
Well, he still has a lot of passionate supporters, and that's one thing we're going to have to watch with Joe Biden. Can he get sort of passionate, energized supporters on his side? Sanders is relying a lot on younger voters, on Latino voters in some of these key states like California. He came close in Texas, but Biden won there. So it's going to be an interesting challenge for Sanders now moving forward. Because in some of the states we've seen so far, compared to 4 years ago when Sanders ran against Hillary Clinton, Sanders' totals this year are down a bit. So that shows he's not quite having the effect he had 4 years ago. And also his theory that you're going to drive out more younger voters to the polls so far is not bearing up. I think, again, what we're seeing now is Democrats rallying around Biden as their pick as the strongest choice to take on President Trump.
Last of all, Elizabeth Warren, the senator from Massachusetts, she had a disappointing showing. She's the last woman in the race. Where does her campaign go now?
Yeah, that's a really good question. She came in third in her home state of Massachusetts, which is not a good sign. And if she continues on, there's a good chance she would pull support from Bernie Sanders. So if she believes that progressives should hold sway, at some point she's going to have to figure out how to get out of the race and perhaps throw her support behind Bernie Sanders.
All right. That was VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Thanks again for joining us, Jim.
You bet.
All right. Now looking into the COVID-19 coronavirus outbreak, Saudi Arabia banned citizens from performing the Muslim pilgrimage in Mecca, Italy weighed closing schools nationwide, and Iran canceled Friday prayers for a second week as nations scrambled Wednesday to control the outbreak. From religion to sports, countries have been taking drastic and increasingly visible measures to curb the new coronavirus that first emerged in China, but has since spread quickly through Europe, the Middle East, the Mideast, and the Americas. Deaths spiked in Iran and Italy, which along with South Korea account for 80% of the new virus cases outside China. That's according to the World Health Organization. In all, more than 94,000 people have contracted the virus worldwide, with more than 3,200 deaths. Now, COVID-19 has especially hit elderly patients and those with already weakened immune systems. To understand why certain groups appear to be more at risk, I spoke to Dr. Jeremy Yude, who is the Dean of the College of Liberal Arts and a Professor of Political Science at the University of Minnesota Duluth, and he's an expert on global health politics. Here's what he had to say.
Well, the big caveat with COVID-19 is that there's still so much that we don't really know yet. And so some of this information that we're finding out about who seems to be vulnerable or where deaths are concentrated may be a bit more anecdotal at this point, and we're still waiting to get more information. So that said, what does seem to be happening is that people who have weakened immune systems for whatever reason, the elderly, the young, are people who are particularly at risk. And this is not terribly outside the realm of what is oftentimes seen with these sorts of diseases. What is a challenge, and the reason that you're seeing some of these restrictions on gatherings and talk about these sorts of policy measures, is that when you've got people that are bunched in close together, that opens up more opportunities for the virus to potentially spread to other people. So if you have something like a nursing home or a care facility in which you've got a lot of people who may not have the strongest immune systems, and the virus is able to take hold in that community, it might find an easier time to spread to other people and potentially cause more illness and more deaths, as opposed to if it's spreading in areas where you don't have people quite as concentrated.
And so, you know, with that in mind, what should public health, officials be doing, or what should governments be doing, whether it's in the U.S. where there's this outbreak inside of a nursing home, inside of a care facility, or other countries? What should be doing to limit, I guess, the chances of this, you know, almost nightmare scenario of an outbreak within a facility for elderly people?
Sure. In a lot of respects, the best advice that we have at this point is similar to what you would see during other times when you've got cold and seasonal flu outbreaks, that you want to make sure that people are covering their mouths if they're coughing or sneezing, that they are getting adequate rest, that they are washing their hands, that they're following all those sorts of common sense sorts of measures, but then also working with their local public health authorities in order to make sure that information is being communicated. So if there is the possibility of an outbreak, we can identify that quickly and then implement the sorts of policies, which could be limiting visitation to those sorts of facilities, or doing things along those lines. With these sorts of public health emergencies, what's really important is communication and trust, that there's adequate communication coming from government officials and that people feel like they can trust them. And so I think so far we've seen the State Departments of Health in particular in the United States doing a really good job about telling people, here is the level of risk that exists, here's what you can do, and here's why you shouldn't necessarily panic at this point. You know, prepare, but don't panic.
And so looking at some other countries, after perhaps the elderly or those who are already sick, probably the next most at-risk group are health workers themselves, the doctors, the nurses, and others who are, you know, dealing directly every day with patients. And we've seen in Italy in particular that there appears to be a shortage of healthcare workers because the outbreak has gotten so bad. In parts of that country, and this situation isn't limited only to Italy. What can health systems do to prepare for a potential shortage of health workers? And then second of all, what can they do, when or if an outbreak hits, to stretch the people who are already available?
This is a big problem when we have these sorts of disease outbreaks because, as you said, healthcare workers are on the front line, and that makes them particularly vulnerable to contracting these sorts of infectious diseases. This is part of the reason why it's so important that people not panic by, say, going out and buying up all sorts of masks, because that limits the availability of those respiratory masks for healthcare workers who actually are in it. Would benefit from being able to have access to them. So a lot of it is about just making sure that there are these sorts of facilities available, these sorts of containment measures, and these sorts of protection materials available for healthcare workers.
That was Dr. Jeremy Ude, who is the Dean of the College of Liberal Arts and Professor of Political Science at the University of Minnesota Duluth, and an expert on global health politics. Israel looked set to slide back into political deadlock on Wednesday as the final votes were being tallied from the third election in less than a year. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party held on to a solid lead but fell short of the outright parliamentary majority needed to form a government. With nearly all the votes counted, Likud led the way with 36 seats, followed by Benny Gantz's centrist Blue and White party with 33 seats. The joint list, which is an umbrella group of Arab-led parties, finished third with 15 seats. That's an all-time high for them. Likud's coalition has 58 of the 120 incoming members of parliament, which is still three votes short of a majority. And the United States conducted an airstrike on Wednesday against Taliban fighters in Afghanistan's southern Helmand province. That's according to a U.S. forces spokesman who said that it's the first such attack since a troop withdrawal agreement was signed between the two sides on Sunday. Colonel Sonny Leggett, the spokesperson for the U.S. forces in Afghanistan, said in a tweet that it was a defensive strike to disrupt an attack on Afghan government forces. After the signing over the weekend, the Taliban said it would resume operations against Afghan forces, though so far it appears that they would continue to hold back on attacks on foreign forces. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jason Patinkin. Now, doctors at a hospital in the Idlib province of Syria, where there's been fighting recently between the Syrian government and rebels, as well as Turkish forces, doctors there say they face a daily struggle to care for expectant mothers amid a Syrian government assault that has driven deep into the province in an attempt to snuff out the last stronghold of rebels in the country. With reporting from Reuters' Olivia Chan, VOA's Ayan Bior has the story.
This is the sound of alarm for warplanes at the entrance of a maternity hospital in Idlib, Syria. And inside, medics are trying to keep newborn babies alive while caring for mothers amid the latest Syrian government assault in the area. Ikram is one of three doctors left working in this hospital. She is also 8 months pregnant. She says, "For me, the latest stage has been the worst of all. It's been very difficult. It's tragic. Tragic. I've reached the stage where I feel I can't go on." Medical staff said there had been a marked rise in miscarriages and premature births in the last 2 months. Some expectant mothers arrive in shock after leaving home in terror during shelling, and every day, four or five babies are found to have died in the womb. In Idlib City's central hospital, surgeon Mohammed Abrash said a missile smashed into the road last week, which left four of his medical staff wounded.
It is so difficult for us to work in this condition. We have to work under stress. Even that, we have to give our experience to our people. We have to serve them. We have to give the first aid for them. We have to treat them, operate them, according to the situation. Like they are staying here in this area, because this is our area. I am from Saraqib city, so I have to stay nearby our people. So we are staying together, and anything will happen to them will happen to us.
Conflict in Syria has escalated in recent days. Russian-backed Syrian government forces have been trying to retake Idlib province, while Turkey launched a counteroffensive in the region. Intense airstrikes and shelling has caused the biggest single displacement of Syrians in the country's nine-year conflict. Nearly a million people have been uprooted since December as they flee the destruction of their towns and villages. Many are sheltering in camps on the Turkish border. But others, with nowhere to go, have taken refuge at a sports stadium in Idlib City. One of them is a young Syrian girl named Jana. She says, the situation here is tragic. There are no bathrooms, there are some toilets, but not very well maintained. And when it rains, the water comes through the tents. Syria's rebels also find themselves squeezed. Rebel Ahmed Mansour speaks in a field, flanked by his comrades. He says, the early days were much better than this. In 2011, 2012, 2013, everything was better than it is now. If we had overcome the mistakes, the factional fighting, and if we were united from the start, because countries did not support us, the world watched us and no one helped us. If the world had helped us from the start, we would have toppled the regime a long time ago. 9 years on and counting, Syria's suffering continues.
That was my colleague Ayan Bior with reporting from Reuters' Olivia Chan. Now, more on the Syria story. Greek and Turkish riot police deployed on their shared border and fired tear gas on Wednesday as hundreds of migrants tried again to cross into Greece amid an escalating war of words between Athens and Ankara about what was happening. Turkey accused Greek forces of shooting dead one migrant and wounding five others, a charge strongly denied by Greece, which said Turkish police were using tear gas to help the migrants illegally cross onto its territory. More than 10,000 migrants have been trying to breach the border since Turkey said last Thursday it would no longer abide by a 2016 deal with the European Union to halt illegal migration flows to Europe in return for billions of euros in aid. For the latest on Europe's attempt to hold back refugees from its territory and the tensions ramping up along the Syria-Turkey border, I spoke with journalist Dorian Jones in Istanbul earlier today. Here's what he had to say.
Well, the situation on the Greek border has witnessed more violent confrontations between the thousands of refugees trying to enter Greece and being pushed back by Greek security forces. There have been a number of serious injuries in the past few days as tensions have been rising. Greece has been adamant it will not allow anyone into its country illegally, not even to declare asylum, which human rights groups say could violate international law. On the Turkish side, President Tayyip Erdogan ruled out he's not backtracking on his decision to keep Turkish borders open for all those who have sought refuge in Turkey and who want to leave to enter Europe, either through neighbouring Greece or Bulgaria. He says simply that Turkey cannot no longer sustain hosting around 4 million refugees. It says the country cannot take any more, and it's up to Europe to share this responsibility. On the Idlib front, there has been more reports of clashes between Turkish forces and Syrian regime forces. This is ahead of a summit meeting between the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, in Moscow with Vladimir Putin, where they are expected to try and find a way out of this deepening military confrontation in Idlib. President Erdogan has been resolute, saying that Turkish forces will not step back. They are determined to protect what they say are people that are fighting for democracy against what he calls his tyrannical regime of the Syrian president al-Assad. But all eyes are now will be on Moscow for the meeting on Thursday.
Looking at that meeting in Moscow, has the Russian side, who is backing Syria's president, Syria's government, have they made any indications of what they would like to see?
Well, the Russians have been keeping their cards very close to their chest. They haven't said very much ever since last week's killing of over 30 Turkish soldiers in an airstrike, which Ankara blames on the Syrian regime, although there was a lot of suspicion that possibly Russian jets were also involved in that attack. Now, it does appear that on the ground, Russia has given the Turkish forces a relatively free hand to carry out retaliation against the Syrian regime. Turkish military drones have inflicted widespread damage, and Russia does have the abilities to prevent those kinds of strikes, but have not done so. Although earlier in the week, Kremlin did start to voice a thinly veiled warning to Ankara, saying it could no longer guarantee the safety of Turkish air operations over Idlib. Now, that is seen as a warning. Russian President Putin does face a major dilemma here. Yes, he's the main backer of the Damascus regime, but at the same time, he wants to try and maintain his very close relationship with Erdogan, which is being seen as a way of undermining Turkey's relationship with NATO, causing discord among Western allies, and also sees Erdogan as an important player for Russia's wider Middle East policy. So there is this very difficult balancing act that Putin will face in Moscow.
Now, Turkey, after the airstrike which killed those Turkish Turkish troops, Turkey called for a no-fly zone over Idlib. Is that something that could be brought up in Moscow as well?
Erdogan talks about no-fly zone. What he will probably be looking for from Moscow is some kind of ceasefire. And there's an expectation he will try to present a plan to create a safe zone, a safe haven in Idlib. Possibly Ankara is talking about a 30-kilometer deep zone running from the Turkish frontier into Idlib. Up till now, Moscow has said that's out of the question. It is also called for a ceasefire and an end to military operations. That remains unclear. Damascus has made it very clear that it wants to reclaim all of its territory. And up until now, Moscow has seemed very sympathetic to that call. But at the same time, Ankara has been looking to its Western allies. Now, it has had very strained relationships with particularly with Washington, but also with its European allies. But it has been reaching out to them ever since the killing of these Turkish soldiers, and it has been calling for some sort of creation of a safe haven, which includes a no-fly zone. And Ankara is very keen at looking for America to deploy its Patriot missile system, which Ankara believes would provide protection for its forces on the ground in Syria. Now, it has to be said, Turkey's Western allies are very reluctant to any idea of deploying forces, which brings a risk of a confrontation with Russian forces.
That was journalist Dorian Jones in Istanbul. The nonprofit group Freedom House released its annual report on the state of democracy around the world. VOA's Arash Arabasadi reports.
Freedom House's annual report says democracy and freedom are in a state of decline around the world. From crackdowns of demonstrators in Hong Kong protesting Chinese rule to repression of crowds in Iran demanding change in the Islamic Republic. The report shows regimes using brute force to maintain control. It also notes disturbing trends in some advanced democracies.
Democracy is in trouble. This year, we've seen an assault on equal rights and the rights of vulnerable groups in both democracies and under brutal regimes. All of this has added up to this being the 14th consecutive year of decline in global democracy.
Sarah Rapucci is vice president of research and analysis at Freedom House. She says more governments have targeted religious and ethnic minorities.
There is definitely a real trend of countries scapegoating a minority population or testing out techniques on a minority population that then they spread more widely.
Rapucci says repressive societies like China use surveillance first on smaller scales before expanding to monitor and control the country at large. Despite that, she says, people in Hong Kong show a determination to fight for freedom.
It's quite clear from the demonstrations in Hong Kong that those people see freedom and democracy as just as important as people in other parts of the world. The movement in Hong Kong is incredibly important and needs to be supported so that the Chinese government wakes up to the reality of what their people want.
Benin had flawed elections last year. Rapucci says the country's freedom and democracy score dropped to levels typically reserved for countries that have a coup or a war.
To have such an extreme change due to an election in a country that had been one of Africa and especially West Africa's success stories is very troubling for the trajectory of democracy in Africa.
She adds that some countries show progress.
Sudan overall is one of the bright spots of the past year. The fact that a popular movement was able to overthrow a president who had been in power for 30 years and had been convicted of genocide is an enormous story.
Rapucci says hope comes from citizens willing to rise up. Even so, Freedom House's annual report shows that countries suffering setbacks outnumber those making gains by a margin of 2-1. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
That's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Have a great evening.
Hello and welcome to Upfront.